Chapter 29. The Other Silver Bullet. It does not remotely detract from Milt Bearden to call him the luckiest station chief in the CIA's history. By most accounts, he was so devilishly effective during his 3 years running the Afghan program that he earned the good fortune with which he began his tour. Bearden was like a man who had inherited great wealth and, instead of screwing it up, managed to build an even greater fortune. Avrakatos had personally recruited Bearden in early 1986 to take over the Islamabad station. Ever since Howard Hart had left, the station had been run by a competent but weak personality named Bill Pikney. Gust had taken advantage of his weakness. Using Charlie's money as leverage, he had trampled on the tradition of the chief of station as king and had managed to call the shots from Langley. But by February 1986, Vickers's redesign was over and Pikney was in trouble. He had been falsely accused, but the mini-scandal confused the political scene, and Avrakatos seized the opportunity to push for his early departure. As Gust saw it, you either have strength in Washington or strength in the field, and with Vickers' work completed, he figured the program needed a classic field marshal. Milt Bearden was not the kind of man that Avrakatos was going to be able to push around, and Gust wanted it that way. Bearden was a Texan, a great storyteller, a natural salesman, and a very tough customer. At the time Avrakatos approached him, he wasn't yet a legend, but he was the veteran of 25 years of operations who had roamed the Third World, managing directors like the Sudan's Numieri. He had won Gust's admiration when Gust had been running the station in Boston, and the two had successfully teamed up to recruit a spy. Later, Avrakatos had spent an evening drinking with him in Texas. They liked each other. And when Gust found out that Bearden was languishing as a deputy division chief for the Far East, an impressive enough title but filled with bureaucracy and no way back into the field for at least 2 years, he hit him with an offer. "I've got a job that'll knock your socks off."
"If it's so great, why aren't you taking it?"
"I would if I could, but Claire won't let me have it."
"Tell me more," Milt said.
Gust amazed him with the description of the size of the program and his conviction that it was working, no matter what the press and the analysts might be saying. And then he described the role of
the crazy congressman from Texas who was behind the program. I told him he would love Charlie and Charlie him, and in fact Charlie did fall in love with Milt. They're both from Texas.
Of the many wonders Bearden discovered about the program upon arriving in Islamabad, the one he found most appealing was that the American press corps was not really asking any questions. It remains one of the great mysteries of this entire history that virtually no one in the press, or Congress for that matter, seemed to care that the CIA was running the biggest operation in its history, that it was supporting efforts to kill thousands of Soviets, that it was fighting a very dirty war, that it was arming tens of thousands of fanatical Muslim fundamentalists. Bearden couldn't quite figure out why no one was concerned about these facts, but he loved it. The only thing the reporters seemed to want to do was get an Afghan to take them into the war zone for an adventure tale of being with the Mujahideen in the Hindu Kush. Bearden recognized another stroke of good fortune. The New York Times man in Pakistan, Arthur Bonner, announced just as Bearden arrived that the war was, in effect, over. The headline read, "Guerrillas are divided and at risk of being conquered." Since the Times is a kind of American Bible insofar as political judgments are concerned, Bearden realized that there was no place for his operation to go but up. Indeed, even the following year, Dan Rather would host a CBS special report concluding that all was lost, and henceforth no reporter would be able to go in. In fact, as Gust had told him, the tide was already turning. No doubt one of the reasons why American reporters and politicians, and indeed the public they represented, didn't pay any attention to the occasional references of how much this war was costing, was because they had all learned to disregard money as being helpful in solving problems. Government wasted money. The poverty program didn't solve poverty. It might have made it worse. The billions spent in Vietnam had backfired. Washington Post cartoonist Herb Bloch loved to draw Caspar Weinberger walking around with a $1,000 toilet seat around his neck, and everyone knew that the CIA screwed up everything it did. Perhaps reporters felt some sympathy toward the poor Afghans. At that time, the Mujahideen cause was almost universally embraced throughout the world. Journalists seemed to find it difficult to undermine the CIA's effort, which appeared to be inadequate in the first place.
Whatever the underlying reason, Bearden thought it totally charming that no one was hunting him down, eager to humiliate and expose him and the giant operation he had just taken over. All of this was just the beginning for the station chief, compared to the great good fortune that began to erupt that summer. On August 26th, the skies of Kabul burst into flames, and Milt, the Afghans, and even the CIA bathed in the glory. The unmistakable conclusion was that the biggest Soviet arms depot in Afghanistan had just been blown up as a result of a very skilled CIA-backed guerrilla maneuver. Bearden, who does not shy from taking credit for his triumphs, offers a disarmingly humble explanation of the agency's role. "This was one that Allah really did do all by himself," he says. But to properly enjoy Bearden's explanation of how this killer blow against the 40th Army was delivered, you have to imagine yourself in the presence of a master storyteller using a Texas accent and knowing that his listener is likely to think that he was personally responsible for placing the C-4 explosives in just the right spot. "Think of an old Mooj," he begins. "Lucky Muhammad, I call him. He's carrying a 37-pound rocket that cost $92. Now, Muhammad's mule has died and he's tired. He stops at a tea house in the mountains on the outskirts of Kabul. And when he goes to lay the rocket down, it falls into a tandoori oven, and it explodes. The rocket strikes a dove over the tea house as it takes off. This changes its trajectory. As a result, the rocket goes straight down the smokestack and blows up the whole dump." At this point, Bearden's audience understands that the much-ballyhooed incident in which a 107mm rocket knocked off 50,000 tons of ammunition was not the product of the CIA's ingenious planners. "A free-flight rocket is a free-flight rocket," explains the station chief. Bearden now reverts back to a straight briefing, explaining that news of this hit, complete with dramatic still photographs and video, was immediately picked up and shown all around the world. Meanwhile, the press corps' favorite Afghan commander, Abdul Haq, immediately claimed credit for the hit. He began to include pictures of the explosions in his party's brochures. Bearden thought this was just fine, since he wanted to give the impression to the Soviets that everything the Mujahideen did was the result of precision planning. "So what if it happened by utter chance? You turned it into a precision operation and let Abdul Haq's story stick. And shit, everyone needs a hero, so let Abdul Haq be a hero and write ballads about being the man who knocked off the 40th Army." Actually, it wasn't all quite the piece of abstract luck that Bearden describes. By the time Lucky Muhammad launched his mortar round, the Mujahideen had taken to launching rocket attacks on Kabul almost daily. These attacks were not very accurate because the Soviets had built up a defensive ring perimeter 11 miles out. On top of that, the Mujahideen didn't want to risk being caught by the gunships, so they tended to fire only at night, knowing they would have time to escape before first light when the hinds could lift off seeking revenge. Even so, the fact was that the Mujahideen were shelling Kabul virtually every day by the time Bearden arrived on the scene. If you fire enough rockets for long enough at the same general target, one day one of them is bound to strike. And this one didn't just explode a lot of enemy ammunition. It made everyone suddenly think that the Mujahideen were finally learning how to really hurt the enemy. That, in fact, was exactly what was happening in the sealed-off indoor training area just outside the Pakistan capital the month Bearden arrived to take up his job. There, a select group of Mujahideen had been tapped to learn how to fire the Stinger. Engineer Rafar was one of the Afghans' most successful gunners, a member of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's arch-fundamentalist Hezb-e-Islami party. Like his leader, Rafar is not the kind of Muslim who smiles on America. So one might wonder how the good engineer felt when he was first handed the dull green 7-foot tube, and how he felt when the red-faced Texan, the American named Milt, went with him to the border to wish him well as he walked off with his band of men. As Rafar crossed the Pakistan border, moved into the tribal zone, and then began traveling across the dry and wasted landscape of southern Afghanistan, he and his men looked little different from their great-grandfathers, who had twice shattered British invasions in the 19th century. The green tubes they carried with them hardly seemed menacing, and if the truth were known, no one at the CIA or the ISI knew whether they would be effective. The Stinger had never yet been deployed in actual combat.